Welcome to today's meeting of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton, the founder of Climate One, and it is my honor right now to introduce Henry Pollack, professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, who will discuss his new book, A World Without Ice, Man's Impact on Climate Change. Please prevent him.
Thank you very much. It's a special pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club of California. I've listened to the discussions from the Commonwealth Club on radio many times, but I never had a visual image of what the Commonwealth Club was actually like. So now it's indelible on my memory. I want to talk to you about my book, but I'm going to take a moment or two to tell you a little bit about myself so you know where I'm coming from with this book. I am basically an earth scientist. I've had lots of different research tracks in my career, the latest of which has been addressing climate change from a particular geophysical viewpoint. I take the temperature of the rocks of the Earth's crust and typically sending thermometers down drill holes and measuring temperature variation as we go down in the Earth. This work was originally focused on measuring the heat coming out of the interior of the Earth and relating that to tectonics and earthquakes and volcanoes. But as time moved on, we had answered many of those questions, and climate change was coming into the fore as a scientific topic towards the end of the 80s, early 90s. So I took a look at some of our measurements down boreholes, and we had always noticed there were a lot of little fluctuations near the surface, and we would just ignore those and go deeper to look for the signal from the deep interior. But we thought maybe there was a signal in these shallower measurements as well. So we went back and re-examined our data with the idea of looking for a signal in the shallow part of our measurements. And lo and behold, there was indeed a signal, and it was a climate signal, one that would let us reconstruct climate back several centuries. The basic technique that this employs, I'll give you an analogy. If you put a rock next to a campfire, the rock will gradually warm up in its interior. And the next morning, even after the campfire is out, if you would drill a little hole into the rock, you'd discover that the interior was still warm. It had a memory of last night when there was a campfire. And with a little mathematics, you can determine how brightly the campfire was burning and how long it burned. In other words, you could reconstruct the climate that that rock felt in earlier times. And that basic principle works for the Earth as a whole. We can take temperatures down into the rocks of the Earth and ask what happened at the surface to produce that profile of temperature. And so we were able to take boreholes from all over the globe and reconstruct temperature changes over the past 500 years, which gives us a glimpse both in the industrial and pre-industrial period, and therefore can give you some insight into factors that have changed through the transition from pre-industrial to industrial. So that's my background in doing climate science. And I had the good fortune, I think, to have my work noticed by Al Gore, who's had many different hats on. But when I first encountered him, it was Senator Gore from Tennessee. And one day I got a telephone call that asked me if I would testify in front of his committee about this new technique of reconstructing past climates. And so I spent a day in Senate hearings with some other climate scientists, and Mr. Gore conducted those hearings with great insight, good questions. I was very impressed that the grasp he had of the scientific facets of climate change. So that was my first exposure to Mr. Gore. And then as my own research continued to grow and mature, we published a paper in Science, which is the flagship journal of the American Association for Advancement of Science. And the next day, I, I got another telephone call, and it was nominally from the White House, and by then Mr. Gore was in the White House, and it said that Mr. Gore had, the caller said that Mr. Gore had read my paper and wanted me to come to Washington and talk to him about it. And I was skeptical. I was sure that it was a big practical joke being played on me by one of my colleagues in the department who wanted to see if I would take the bait. But as I talked on, I decided this really was a call from the White House. And so when the request came, could I come to Washington and talk with him about it the next day, I said, well, I'd have to check my teaching schedule, but I think I can make it. And so the next day I went to Washington and spent the day in the Office of Science and Technology Policy, about an hour with Mr. Gore and with Neil Lane, who was the president's science advisor, and then much of the rest of the day with the staff in OSTP. And so that was my second encounter with Mr. Gore. Another 5 years into the future, fast forward, and I got another call, and it was, again, Mr. Gore's staff. It had come after the film The Inconvenient Truth had been put out and had such widespread viewing. And he was planning something called the Climate Project, which some of you in the audience are very familiar with. And the Climate Project was designed to bring community volunteers to a short training session in Nashville, which is Mr. Gore's home, so that they could present the scientific story of climate change as outlined in the Inconvenient Truth film, and then go back home and speak to schools and congregations and service clubs, alumni clubs, whatever audience you could put together, and continue to spread the word about climate change. Now, I mentioned that long background in part because in addition to my scientific work, I also have been puzzled by the disconnect of the almost certain conclusions that scientists have come up with about the reality of climate change and that humans are involved with it 9 chances out of 10. And the perception by the general public that there, you know, still half the people don't even think that climate change is happening, and that the humans are a part of it. Well, that's even further down their list. And so I've been very interested in trying to reach the general non-scientific public and take every opportunity to talk about climate change, because I think it is very real, and that humans are playing a big part in it, and the consequences will not be pretty. And we don't have a lot of time to dilly-dally about thinking about whether it's something we want to address. So all that is the background to this book, which is part of my attempts to communicate with the general public about the realities of climate change. Now, the book is about ice, climate, and people. Ice has played a role in the development of Earth's landscape, its climate, and has provided certain constraints on the development and spread of human civilization. And there has been a reciprocal impact in the present day about people having an effect on the planet's ice. And the story of climate change is the common theme that is woven throughout this book. Now, the question that I often receive is, why did I choose ice as the vehicle to tell this story? Why is it that ice is, in my view, a ideal prism to view the story of climate change? There are, in my mind, three principal reasons. The first is that ice is a big player in the global climate system. Ice is a very reflective substance. Any of you who have been skiing, and if you're not careful, you can get sunburned from the reflections from below you, not just from the sun above you, but reflections from the snow and ice can give you quite a good sunburn. So ice on the globe, it sits presently like two white skull caps in the polar regions. And these white regions reflect a lot of energy back to space that would otherwise warm the Earth. And so if we have a loss of ice, we're also going to see a greater amount of energy that is falling on darker surfaces and being absorbed and leading to a warming. So the mere fact that ice is a prominent player in the climate system of the globe was one reason I wanted to use it as a theme for the book. A second reason is that ice is a sensitive and unambiguous indicator of climate change. Because the ice of the Earth is very close to its melting point over the Earth, just a few degrees of temperature change can lead to significant changes in the distribution of ice on Earth. And so when we watch ice in retreat due to some modest increases in temperature over the globe, you can see how sensitive ice is to this equilibrium that it has with the Earth's temperature. And I like ice also as an indicator of climate change for its political neutrality. What I say about ice in the book is that I'm going to read it to you. It's the only part of this will be called a book reading. Ice asks no questions, presents no arguments, reads no newspapers, listens to no debates. It's not burdened by ideology and carries no political baggage as it crosses the threshold from solid to liquid. It just melts. And I think that in that context, ice is one of nature's best thermometers. You may not believe man-made thermometers. We've heard arguments from the climate skeptics about those. But, ice is nature's thermometer. And you just need to watch ice and you see climate change in action. So that was another reason that I chose ice as the prism to view climate change. And the third reason was that the consequences of losing ice on Earth are very profound in several different ways, but two are very prominent. One is the loss of mountaintop glaciers in the mid and tropical latitudes of Earth. These glaciers, which reside in such places as Rocky Mountain, or Glacier National Park, a little bit in Rocky Mountain National Park, on top of the high peaks of the Andes in South America, on many of the peaks in the Himalaya and in the Tibetan Plateau of Asia, these glaciers are melting. They're retreating. They're losing their ice. And these glaciers, along with the seasonal snowfall, provide the agricultural water and the domestic water for about a third of the Earth's population. And while the ice exists, there's still an ample supply of water for those purposes. Once the glaciers are gone, the annual snowfall is inadequate to meet the needs that are the consumption levels that are presently taking place. So I'm very concerned about the impact on large numbers of people. As I said, about a third of the Earth's population will be affected by the loss of mountain glaciers. The other big impact is that as you melt ice on the continents, it gradually runs downhill and enters the ocean and provides new water to the oceans that will raise sea level. Now, melted ice is not the only reason sea level rises. Sea level also rises because the oceans themselves are warming and thermal expansion of ocean water is a contributor to the rise of sea level as well. And so, but the net effect is that sea level is rising due both to the warming and to the addition of new water. And a meter of sea level rise, so around 3 feet of sea level rise, will impact 100 million people around the globe. When you look at the number of people who live in various elevation bands above sea level, the lowest level from sea level to 1 meter high is home to 100 million people. And if you would raise sea level even more, of course, you would be impacting more people. And so it will lead to a very serious dislocation of the human population of the globe with only modest increases in sea level. And so the significance of raising sea level through the loss of ice is an issue that also, I think, is a reason to use ice as the theme for the book. Now, the structure of the book is to look at the relationship between ice and people through a panorama of time. And I start during the maximum of the last ice age, 20,000 years ago, when there was much more ice on the continents and many fewer people. The extent of ice 20,000 years ago in North America, it covered virtually all of Canada and extended into the USA as far south as the Missouri River in the west and the Ohio River in the east. And in fact, those rivers are where they are because they were carrying away the meltwater from the glaciers as the last ice age ended. And those are big river systems that today carry much less water than they did at the time when the ice was melting. So there was a lot more ice. In Europe, the ice extended south to about the Midlands of the United Kingdom, covered much of northern Europe, some of northern Russia and northern Asia, and, of course, high peaks in the Himalaya, and even here in California, the Sierra was the home of big glaciers, and Yosemite Valley is a marvelous example of glacial sculpting that was a gift of the last ice age to the present occupants of Earth. And other beautiful examples of the legacy of the last ice age are the Great Lakes of the mid-continent, the Finger Lakes of New York are big gouges that were scratched out in the bedrock of New York by the advancing ice. Long Island is an outwash plain and moraine of glacial origin. So you can tell I'm a geologist and I see all of these topographic features in terms of geological origins. Another facet of the last ice age that affected people was that when you have so much ice on the continents, you have taken water out of the oceans to do that. And so ice and water are like playmates on a seesaw. When there is a lot of ice on the continents, there's less water in the oceans. And conversely, when you have less ice on the continents, there's more water in the oceans. So the last ice age saw the a depression of sea level by almost 400 feet. And it was that lowering of sea level that provided the avenues of a walkway for the peopling of all the continents. At that time, the English Channel between England and France was a dry walkway. The Bering Strait was dry, and people migrated from Asia to the Americas. So the lowering of sea level provided pathways for human migration. So now we move to the present day, when there's a lot less ice and a lot more people. Now, the lot less ice, you can only think of it as less ice in terms of what there used to be, but ice today sits mainly in two big patches, one on Greenland and one on Antarctica. The Antarctic pile is bigger than Greenland's. And there is ice that covers the Arctic Ocean. This is called sea ice. It is just frozen seawater. And it's much thinner than the ice caps on Greenland and Antarctica. But it plays an important role in the reflection of sunlight that I mentioned earlier. So we have much less ice, and we have a lot more people. At the peak of the last ice age, there were perhaps 1 million people scattered all over the globe, or almost all over the globe. And the population was perhaps 1 million, which I think is probably about the population of San Jose close by, or pick out any other city you want. But imagine all those people distributed over the globe. It's a much lower population density than we have today. Now, since the peak of the last ice age 20,000 years ago, people have multiplied, like the stars in the sky or the sand on the beach is the usual analogy. But the Earth's population reached 1 billion people in 1800. That took almost 20,000 years to accumulate 1 billion people. But it only took another 130 years to accumulate another billion people. By 1930, the population of the globe was 2 billion. And it only took another 25 years to reach 3 billion in 1955. And it only took another 19 years to reach 4 billion in 1974. And right now we're close to 7 billion, and by 2020 or so we'll be at 8 billion, and by mid-century at 9 billion, according to the United Nations projections. This is an astounding growth in the human population. Just to give you a feeling for it, if you were trying to create 7 billion people by giving birth one new person every second and no one ever died, it would take more than 200 years of a baby every second to equal 7 billion people. So we've had a lot more people on Earth who are able to interact with the Earth, and they become much more powerful because they learn to use energy, fossil energy mostly, in the last couple hundred years. And as a result, we have a lot of people that are using a lot of energy, and they're doing a lot to the Earth. And of course, I'm going to talk to you about what they're doing to the climate, but let me just put into context what other things are happening. People move more Earth today than rivers do. People in the east, in the Appalachian Mountains, mining for coal, they are employing something called mountaintop removal. It's quite a graphic term, where they simply blow the bedrock off the tops of mountains to expose the coal beds. They throw the bedrock into the valleys adjacent. And that's happened to almost 500 separate sites along the crests of the Appalachian. We have interfered with the natural flow of every river in the USA of any magnitude. There are no unfettered rivers flowing to the sea. We have major dams on virtually every stream, sometimes multiple dams, that control the flow of the river entirely. In Asia, we had diverted the waters of waters that fed the Aral Sea. The Aral Sea, 50 years ago, was a body of water about the size of Lake Huron. It's one of the largest bodies of water on the globe. Today, it's nearly dried out, and there are fishing vessels sitting on the sand as the water that used to flow into the Aral Sea has been diverted for agriculture in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. We have washed chemicals off the land through the chemicals applied as fertilizers or simply the impervious surfaces of our big cities. When we have rainfall, it sends chemicals into the streams and they make their way to the ocean, and we're producing dead zones in the ocean where literally nothing can live because of the chemical pollution. We have injected a lot of material into the atmosphere. You'll recall days when Los Angeles was smog-covered, and of course it's not alone, Many other cities were that way. That got transported as acid rain and fell in our forests and in our lakes, killing the trees and the fish. And we have done other things to the atmosphere. We injected a lot of chlorofluorocarbons into the atmosphere and unwittingly created a loss of stratospheric ozone that we call the ozone hole over Antarctica. And incidentally, we have also pumped a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that has the property of trapping heat that is trying to leave the Earth and return to space, and as a result, it acts as a blanket that is warming the Earth. And so our increase in the effectiveness of the greenhouse layer in our atmosphere has led to a warming of the Earth of little more than 1 degree Celsius or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past century. And what has the impact been of that? Well, the mountain glaciers that I described have all been retreating in their valleys. The sometimes a retreat is many miles. Sometimes it's only a fraction of a mile. But it's crystal clear that mountain glaciers everywhere are retreating. And at the pace of the retreat, we'll see the last of mountain glaciers in the next few decades. Speculation that Glacier National Park will have lost its namesake glaciers in another two or three decades. Kilimanjaro on the equator in Africa probably won't last more than another decade. And mountain glaciers everywhere, if you're looking for a time frame of the consequences of climate change, the mountain glaciers are on the decadal timescale. Another big change in the ice of the Earth is in the Arctic Ocean. The Arctic Ocean freezes every winter, and over the summer, part of it breaks up as summertime comes to the Arctic. And the amount of the loss of summer sea ice has been monitored by satellites since the late 70s. But even prior to that, submarines from both Russia and the USA were prowling beneath the Arctic sea ice, spying on each other and mapping topography and the like, and incidentally giving us a record of the sea ice distribution ever since the beginning of the Cold War. So we have records gathered by the military for the last half of the 20th century, and what we see is that the loss of summertime sea ice in the Arctic is accelerating. And today, the area of summertime sea ice is only about 60% of what it was in mid-century. And the thickness of the sea ice is down by half. And the for the first time in human history, both the Northwest Passage and the Northeast Passage from North America and Europe to Asia were both open last year. The projections of the loss of Arctic sea ice in the future is that we'll see an ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime in just a few decades. And that will bring big changes to the Arctic. There will be increased exploration for minerals and petroleum. There will be fisheries fleets moving into the Arctic to mine the fisheries that have been protected by the ice. There will be international posturing as to who owns the terrain of the Arctic, which has been a question no one's cared much about while there was ice cover everywhere. But as it's becoming open, we're going to see international tensions rise. And there is even bigger ice losses that are underway that are ominous. The amount of ice on Greenland and the amount of ice on West Antarctica, which is the lesser pile of ice in the Antarctic, is such that each Greenland and West Africa could, if we would remove all the ice and put it into the ocean, it would raise sea level, each one would raise sea level 20 feet. Now, 20 feet is a big change in sea level, and I'm not predicting that we're going to lose all of the ice from either one. But what we've noticed is that as summertime melting on Greenland, for instance, is creeping upward as the atmosphere is warming, we're finding more and more of the summer meltwater is plunging down fissures in the ice, crevasses, and going right to the base of the ice between where the ice sits on the rock, and it's lubricating the base of the ice. And the ice is slipping off much faster. The glaciers around Greenland are accelerating and delivering ice much faster than the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had projected to be taking place in their last report of 2007. And so we're seeing the acceleration of ice loss from both Greenland and West Antarctica, dislodging huge pieces of ice shelves in the Antarctic and big icebergs from the Greenland glaciers. And most projections of the rise in sea level have changed from something on the order of a foot and a half to 2.5 feet in the IPCC report to somewhere between 3 and 6 feet at the end of the 21st century. And so the IPCC projections of sea level change are self-acknowledged as being lower estimates, as being very conservative because of this new phenomenon of increased ice dynamics as the glaciers are slipping off of the of Greenland and West Antarctica. Now, 6 feet of climate change, or 6 feet of sea level rise, or even 3 feet, would be dramatic changes to the face of the Earth. It would, as I say, 3 feet would displace 100 million people around the globe. Our experience with climate refugees that we garnered from Hurricane Katrina and the evacuation of New Orleans involved 150,000 people. And 100 million people over this century would be like 7 Katrinas every year. And the globe is unprepared for the social problems that will come with the rise of sea level and the displacement of people around the globe. So we have some big problems facing us, and we need to, number one, take our heads out of the sand, and we can no longer think that it's a problem for the next generation. It's a problem that certainly will affect the next generation, but it's not exactly a gift that we want to pass on to them. And so the issues of what to do about it come up, and how shall we forestall climate change or the worst of it? Some of it will come anyway because of what we've already done to the atmosphere. There will be inertia in the climate system. But there's some hope that we can forestall the very worst. Just a little bit on the timetable of trying to mitigate climate change. Currently, the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere is 390 parts per million. There are some who believe that it should never have gone over 350 if we were to avoid unhappy consequences. Others think that 450 might forestall the very worst. But we're currently, under the current industrial economy, pumping 2 to 3 parts per million into the atmosphere every year. And so you can do the arithmetic to go from 390 to 450, which is the upper limit that people are thinking we could still deal with. At 2 or 3 parts per million each year, that gives us 20 or 30 years to totally stabilize the emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And that's the task that's in front of us in terms of our individual choices and our governmental actions. And I'm not going to talk a whole lot about policy from the podium, but I'd be happy to engage with you in discussions after I shut up and sit down, so to speak. And so, but it, the the image that I'd like to leave with you is that unless there are some big changes soon, we're going to see big changes on Earth that will not be a pretty picture. And so the urgency of the problem is real, and we all have a responsibility to do what we can, both individually and collectively, to forestall the very worst. So I'm going to stop now and again thank all of you for coming, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity to speak both here and to the wider audience through your broadcasts. And I'd be delighted to hear from you, your own comments and your own experience and your own questions about this topic. So again, thank you very much. And I'd like to open up for discussion.
Our thanks to Henry Pollack, professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, for his comments today here at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. And professor, we have a number of questions. I'd like to structure them. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about science. We have some air questions, some water questions, some land questions, all revolving around ice. And one is that recently there's been talk of a stabilization of the climate. I guess there's been 8 years of some climate temperature stability. Is that significant? Does that mean that the warming has stopped? There's some people who suggest that that raises some doubt about the trends over larger years. So let's address that one first.
I'd be happy to. That's a distraction rather than a total rethinking of what's happening to the climate. When we talk about climate change, we're talking about long-term trends, in this case over a century or more. We know that year by year, the years are warmer and then colder, they oscillate, and even on longer time periods, like a decade or so, we sometimes see the climate plateauing for a while. It happened during the 1950s, it happened in the 1890s, and for the last 8 years, it has been stable likewise and not climbing inexorably. But you have to remember that the plateau that we're at now is a full degree Celsius or 2 degrees warmer than it was a century ago. The decade of the first decade of this century is the warmest decade on history. And so we should never lose sight of that. You can't ask the climate to incrementally climb every year. There's too many variables that allow for interannual and interdecadal variability. But there's no question that we're much warmer than we were a century ago, and there have been pauses in the climb before, and climate models show that pauses are a very common phenomenon. So I don't put a lot of stock in that argument that maybe climate global warming is over.
Another question is about uncertainty inherent in science. The IPCC and a lot of scientists often say 99% probability. That 1% is often seized upon by people who say, well, you're not sure, there's doubt. So let's address the uncertainty and how sure you are about these conclusions that you've stated.
Let me here make a plug for an earlier book I wrote called Uncertain Science, Uncertain World, and point out that we live with uncertainty all the time, and we seldom let it prevent us from making important decisions of life. Uncertainty should not lead to policy paralysis. Uncertainty is part of the world. And the two questions, well, there are several questions, but the two that lead the list in terms of climate change are, one, is the climate changing? And two, are humans playing a significant role in it? Now, the IPCC in its 2007 report answered the first question by saying that climate change is unequivocal. That's an extremely strong word for scientists to use. Unequivocal means, you know, there's no mistaking it. There's no question left that every line of evidence is suggesting very strongly that climate is changing. And when you recognize the strength of the whole body of independent lines of evidence, you come away very strongly persuaded that yes, indeed, climate change is real. So the scientific community basically has said there really is no uncertainty that the climate is changing. Now, the question of are humans a part of it was also addressed by the IPCC, and their conclusion was that there is a 90% probability that humans are the major factor in climate change since the middle of the 20th century. Now, you can focus on the 10% that's left as uncertainty, but I like to point out that 9 out of 10 are very good odds. If you walked into a casino and the owner of the casino said, play any game you want, and I'll guarantee that you win 9 chances out of 10, you'd probably walk out with a lot of cash in your pocket. So I think that you have to recognize what a 90% probability really means. It's a very strong statement. Yes, with a little bit of wiggle room, but I wouldn't want to wiggle in that space. The conclusion is very strong that humans are playing a very strong role. And one of the reasons that I have an entire chapter in the book devoted to the human fingerprint on Earth, or the human footprint. And in it I talked about, moving Earth and damming rivers and polluting the oceans and polluting the atmosphere, because I wanted to lay the groundwork that humans are doing a lot of things on Earth. Climate change is not just, the principal effect. It's just one of many effects. And once you see all the things that humans are capable of doing, you recognize that humans are the most important geological agent on the planet today, then grasping their role in climate change is less of a daunting task. So I think there will be uncertainty, but if we wait for uncertainty to disappear, we'll wait forever. And we have to move on in the face of uncertainty.
I heard Energy Secretary Chu talk last night about this, and he said if people were told that there was a 60% chance that an airplane you were on would make it to its destination safely, you would think very differently. We make all sorts of decisions with different types of probability in our lives. And staying with probability, what do you think the probability is for significant collapse of Greenland or Western Antarctica ice sheets this century?
The word collapse is a loaded word. Do I think that we're going to lose all the ice off of Greenland and Antarctica? No, I don't. But might we lose enough ice off of it? As I said, the potential sea level rise from Greenland and West Antarctica is together 40 feet. Do I think we might get a foot or two out of those bodies of ice? I think it's a real possibility. And so when I said I think that there's a decent likelihood that instead of 2 feet of sea level rise that the IPCC had pointed to, that we might see as much as anywhere from 3 to 6. And that would be the contributions of ice from Greenland and West Antarctica.
So to recap, you think we might see 3 to 6 this century?
Mind you, I'm not making a prediction, but everything I see says that that's a real possibility.
And how about the time frame? Because a lot of the science seems to focus on 2100, which is hard for a lot of humans to grok. And are you comfortable making things that are 2030, 2050, where people can sort of say, that'll happen in my lifetime, or at least my children, not be so far in the future to be challengingly remote?
Well, there are three timescales, really. There's the decadal timescale, which will, affect the mountain glaciers and the Arctic sea ice. Those are on decadal timescales, and so those are definitely things we're going to see in both our lifetime and our children's lifetime. There's the century-long timescale, which is the one for significant ice loss from Greenland and West Antarctica. And again, I emphasize, I'm not talking about losing at all. You don't have to lose at all. A relatively small fraction of that ice, if it drops into the ocean, will raise sea level another few feet. And I think that's on a century timescale. The total loss of ice from East Antarctica, which has the potential for 200 feet of sea level, I think is a long way away, in part because East Antarctica is very high, and so it's also very cold, and warming of the atmosphere from an extremely cold temperature doesn't lead to a lot of melting or ice loss. So the East Antarctic ice pile is much more stable. And I think we're looking at, on a millennial timescale, for possible loss of significant amounts of that.
And staying in Antarctica for a moment, is there truth to the drilling, that the drilling in Antarctica 2 miles down revealed tropical plants?
Well, you don't have to drill through the ice. The rocks of the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, which stick up through the ice, have coal beds in them. And so the answer is very definitely yes, that Antarctica in its geological history many millions of years ago was in a more tropical location. But the processes of plate tectonics have moved it south and put it over the pole. And since it's been at the pole and glaciated over the last 30 million years or so, there's been no tropical plants growing.
Henry Pollack is professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, and he's discussing a world without ice at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. Another question from the audience is, what are the implications of permafrost melting?
Permafrost is frozen ground, and much of the Arctic, surrounding the Arctic Ocean, is underlain by permafrost in Alaska, northern Canada, northern Scandinavia, Siberia, and the like. And the permafrost in some places goes very deep. It's a frozen, in fact, a frozen relic of the last ice age, and it's never warmed up enough to eliminate permafrost. Now, currently, we are seeing the permafrost softening and melting. One of the best indicators of that is something called tundra travel days in Alaska, which are the number of days you can drive a truck or a vehicle across the frozen ground and have a good solid foundation. That duration of time has shrunk by months as the permafrost has softened. And now the number of months you can drive across the tundra, I think, is reduced to about 4 months, whereas it used to be almost twice that long. So we are seeing the permafrost softening and melting. And in Siberia, the same is true. We're seeing longer periods where we're getting melting in the summertime. And there are little lakes forming that from the meltwater. There's methane bubbling out in these lakes. The permafrost is well known to contain a lot of organic material that will release methane. And since methane itself is a greenhouse gas, there's concern about another melting episode that will simply add more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. The good news there is that the rate at which you can melt permafrost is governed by the physics of heat diffusion going down into the earth, and that's a slow process. So the time scale of total disruption of the permafrost is a long one. It's not a trivial one, but it's not a problem that will reach a tipping point and suddenly lead to huge amounts coming out. So that's more of a centuries and millennial timescale problem that we need to be aware of, but it's perhaps a little longer drawn out phenomenon.
It is making, as you mentioned, oil accessible in that area, both on land and at sea. And I traveled up there in 2007, and there was a lot of local people who liked the idea of oil drilling up there because it would affect their, frankly, very poverty-stricken subsistence living, and had thoughts of, like, who are we to say they can't drill in their water up there? So let's address the oil drilling, both from a geologic standpoint as well as an accessibility standpoint.
Well, I think that there's little question that there will be petroleum and natural gas possibilities in the Arctic Ocean. The continental shelves nearly everywhere have been productive, and there's little reason to think that the continental shelves of the Arctic are going to be different. And so there will be great interest. The U.S. Geological Survey has already done an estimate of what the possible petroleum reserves of the Arctic Ocean will be. And we've seen drilling ships already drilling the sedimentary record at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean for scientific purposes. But what it has done, of course, is to demonstrate that it's entirely feasible to have drilling operations in the Arctic. And surely the exploration companies will be there in short order. As to who owns the continental shelves, there's some great debate. The Arctic Ocean has a feature that crosses from Asia to North America. And in a sense, it's a a continental shelf that connects the two. Well, every country can claim the continental shelf that's attached to their territory, but this is attached to several territories. So it's leading to a geopolitical issue as to who has the exploration rights, and that has yet to be worked out, too.
I mean, advocates of that say that the drilling techniques, and we've even had some prominent environmentalists at the Commonwealth Club say that it's not the extraction that's the problem, that the drilling has become much less intrusive to wildlife, et cetera. It's the burning. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's a hostile environment no matter what. And so there's always the increased risk of accidents just because there will be wintertime refreezing of the installations that are, semi-permanent. And so I think that there's, because of the environment, there's always the chance for spills and unanticipated difficulties in extraction. But it's very clear that if there is petroleum and it makes its way into the world energy market, it'll end up as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that certainly is a long-term prospect that we shouldn't look forward to.
How will reductions in ice affect weather, such as wind and rain?
How will the reduction of ice affect weather? Well, already we're seeing climate change impose itself in many ways. Of course, the loss of ice is just one. We're seeing that as the atmosphere warms, their ability to hold water vapor increases. The warmer the atmosphere is, the more water vapor it can hold and eventually drop as precipitation. So we're seeing more intense precipitation events that are really of a scale that's dramatic. New York City had a single rainstorm 2 years ago that dropped something like 8 inches in a few hours on Central Park. And the previous record from a century ago was only 2 inches. And that, I think, came during a hurricane that had blown up the East Coast. You recall the major floods in Iowa just a year ago that came from as much as 20 inches of precipitation in 3 or 4 days. So these intense precipitation events are becoming a greater and greater occurrence, more frequent occurrence. And in terms of what the loss of ice specifically will do, it has influence on ocean currents, and particularly in the Arctic, where I'll take a little side trip. The Arctic is much warmer than the Antarctic, in part because the currents in the Atlantic Ocean carry warm water to the north. We call that the Gulf Stream. And in fact, they go so far north and wrap around the north of Scandinavia and into the Arctic Ocean that the Russian port of Murmansk is an ice-free port year-round, even though it's well north of the Arctic Circle. And the reason that the Gulf Stream can flow north into the Arctic is that there has to be room for that new water to enter. And the way the Arctic Ocean accommodates, makes space for it, is to have cold water sink and flow along the bottom of the ocean going south. And so you have a big conveyor belt of ocean currents with warm water going north of the surface and cold water going south. Now, with the loss of ice in the Arctic Ocean, you're seeing changes in the dynamics there, in part because there's a lot more fresh water coming into the Arctic Ocean from the Asian rivers that feed the Arctic Ocean and from the melting of the permafrost. And so you're putting a lot of fresh water into the Arctic. And fresh water is less dense than salt water. That means it sits at the top. It doesn't want to sink. And as you lose summer sea ice, the sunshine, instead of being reflected back to space, is now falling on dark ocean water and warming it up. And warm water is more buoyant than cold water. And so both fresh, warm water phenomena in the Arctic has the potential to slow down the sinking of water to the bottom and therefore slow down the Gulf Stream in bringing fresh water or warm water north. So the potential for altering ocean currents is real, but again, the timetable for that, there's been no extensive set of observations that suggest that the currents are even slowing down, and most calculations about it say that throughout the 21st century, it's not likely to be a serious problem. Beyond that, it could be.
Let's stick with water in terms of fresh water. You mentioned some of the melting ice pack and its impacts on rivers, and that would affect, I think you said, one-third of the people in the world. Could you unpack that a little bit? How's that going to unfold, and what kind of alternatives will there be for fresh water sources?
It's a big worry for a lot of countries. I'm more familiar with the Andean countries because I travel to South America on my way to the Antarctic frequently. And the west coast of South America is basically a coastal desert. And yet it's amazingly productive agriculturally because of the irrigation that's possible from the mountain snow and ice melting. And so the vineyards of Chile and the flower beds and such that we find being exported to North America and Europe, the possibility of losing that agriculture is very real because the seasonal snowfall is not enough to provide all the water that agriculture currently uses. And so once the mountain glaciers are gone, the Andean countries are facing a real issue. Whether there is replacement water is a big question. Where does it come from? Do you drill a tunnel through the Andes and bring it in from the Brazilian rainforest? That's a titanic engineering project. And for Chile, that doesn't do much because it's adjacent to Argentina, and already Argentina in its western parts is very arid and not a great source of water either. So I think we're seeing big problems that I don't see any obvious solution. The only possibility might be is if we hurry up and learn how to desalinate water from the sea efficiently and with a sufficient economy, we might be able to draw seawater inland to do the irrigation that currently the mountain glaciers and winter snowfall do.
And also the energy intensity, I think, is that part of you're talking about. It's very energy intensive to desalinate salt water. We reached the point where we have just one last question. And this is from the audience saying, is there anyone keeping track of the changing projections that are always sooner than projected? There's lots of different scientific voices out there, and the news always seems to be things are happening more dramatically sooner. So is there a way to sort of, so people can look to keep track of all that, or any institution doing that?
Not that I know of. There is no institution that is kind of gathering all the independent projections. One, of course, if you are a voracious reader of the scientific literature, you can keep on top of it. But there are very few people who have the time or the inclination to do that. So I think that it's impressionistic. But you're absolutely right that there are no projections that are saying that the IPCC was over-alarmist. All projections that I know are predicting an accelerated ice loss, an accelerated melting, and they say that the IPCC has to be given the status of a minimal estimate, that all new projections are exceeding what the IPCC said.
Well, I want to add on one light note. We have a question, which I think is in jest. Does this mean my martinis will be warm?
Well, of course, your martinis are usually cooled in the refrigerator or with an ice cube, perhaps. And so with enough energy, we can make ice. But I think that's maybe you would even want to do that to keep your martini chilled.
Start a new trend, warm martinis. Our thanks to Henry Pollack, professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, for his comments today on A World Without Ice, Man's Impact on Climate Change. And now this program of Climate One is adjourned.